Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 68.
Can you believe it?
We have our senior discount. We are elderly at this point.
That basically makes the Jell-O cup free.
Oh, by the way, this is the morning after.
On Heritage Radio Network?
Yeah.
That org?
I'm your host, Jesse Kiefer.
And I'm Jen Tulloch. It's lovely to be back.
Jen, how's your spring been?
It's been sprung. It's been lovely. I went to the Highline the other day, and I purchased some gelato. I noticed that Terroir on the Highline was not yet open.
I hear May 3rd.
May 3rd?
The only place that sells booze on the Highline. So
oh, God.
We've kind of got the market cornered on the Highline.
Sing my song, sister. It was last spring and summer that was pretty much my final destination for every afternoon.
Oh,
it's
really?
Great. If any of you have not been to Terroir on the Highline,
I mean, I think everyone has been there, and it makes me sad when y'all don't come into Tribeca because you're like, oh, well, the Highline's kind of close. It's by the water.
I don't have to tell you that I'm a borderline annoying frequenter of Terroir Tribeca.
Borderline annoying.
When does Summer of Riesling starts?
Oh, when the summer starts, which is probably June. I'm going to say brainstorming June 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, something like that.
This is going to be my summer of risotto and Riesling. That's all I want to consume.
I can't wait you to be in there. This spring, I'm very proud of a lot of friends of mine. It's kind of been in the industry long enough where now I'm seeing my friends opening places. And two people that we've had on the show to talk about their up and coming restaurant have actually done it. They've opened it. Nick Padilla we had on the show very recently. I just went to their friends and family of Alameda, which is on Green and Franklin in Greenpoint.
How was it?
It was packed. I didn't get any food. I was thrown shots of whiskey, bottles of Jura, and really, I was.
Thanks for the phone call.
Yeah, exactly. They were just like pouring things. People just had their mouths open. No, not really.
Just you.
Like that. Just me. But no, it's a gorgeous space. The Hasselgrave brothers are the designers and part owners, and it's just beautiful. So I'm sure they will not need more press and more people knowing about it. But hey, it never
hurts, I can't wait to check it out.
And then good friends Gabriela and Gustavo Lopez, who opened Vinateria up on 119 in Frederick Douglass. So I like hearing about these restaurants that I really respect, and I'm really excited about opening in places that, you know, not everybody is opening stuff in.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I checked out, Vinateria, and it was amazing. I had a wonderful time. I will probably not be up there for another year. I live in the East Village.
Up in the nosebleed.
Very, very
up in the nosebleeds.
Away.
I live in Bushwick, so I pretty much have to take a pack mule to a private jet to get up there. But I'll do it.
Well, not talking about, you know, things I've done, earlier in the week today, what I'm doing right now, sitting in studio with two very tall, handsome gentlemen, and I'm incredibly excited to interview both of them. We have Ian McGregor. He is the chief fishmonger and president of the Lobster Place in Chelsea Market.
Hi.
Welcome to the morning after.
Pleasure to be here.
And we also have Mr. Levy Dalton. He is a sommelier. He's a blogger. He's a wine editor for Eater. And he is the host of the podcast, I'll Drink to That.
Hello.
The interviewee or the interviewer gets interviewed.
That's true. If you're going to quote me to me, though, I might get a little freaked out.
No, don't. I don't think I'm going to quote you, actually.
I have to say this is a delicious, delicious Jell-O cup. Thank you for having me here.
It's frozen pineapple. You can't get better than that.
Yeah, you're just going to keep me like on the edge of my seat today. Tonight.
It's hard to be on
tonight.
The edge
it's
of the
seat. It's the morning
seat
after, and
the...
it's tonight. Jen, you remember when we first hosted the show together?
Just barely.
Because we're elderly now.
There was a lot of wine. There was a lot of wine.
I think you blacked out for that moment.
It was a gray out.
So, when we first started hosting together, Jen and I were hashing out some segments, and they've now kind of become staples of the front of house and what's on the menu at Chardonnay's. So we thought it would be great to do a little throwback to the front of house. One of my favorite bits that you've done on the show, one of my favorite stories, was about crumbing.
It was about crumbing, the ancient art.
What is crumbing?
Crumbing, for those not familiar, is the art of removing crumbs from a table with a small shoehorn-looking device, typically onto a bread plate, a napkin, or, if you want to be fired, your hand. Or other things, as you may hear in the segment. Joe, do we have that? When I was hired as a server at Restaurant X, my only previous service experience was a Marriott retirement community and 2 weeks at a Texas Roadhouse in Decatur, Illinois. By the grace of a few friends and a series of blatant lies, I found myself working at a fine dining French bistro on 43rd Street. I was terrified of being exposed as an imposter, which is what I was, and desperately needed the money, so I told myself I'd just keep a low profile. This, I would soon find out, is impossible in a well-lit room with three caffeinated managers. I was constantly being criticized for my lack of wine knowledge, told to carry plates differently, reminded to serve from the left and clear from the right, and above all, to crumb the tables. To leave a table uncrumbed at Restaurant X was met with the same disdain as leaving your baby in a hot car. Now, of the many tedious devil rituals they force you to perform in fine dining, few are less important than the art of crumbing. Crumbing, for those of you less familiar, is the process of taking a tiny metal shoehorn-looking device and scraping it along the table until all the crumbs are swept onto a napkin or a bread plate. Now, I didn't yet know the difference between a Bordeaux and a Burgundy glass, but goddammit, I could crumb. This particular spring day, I'd been assigned to work brunch, otherwise known as Mimosa Purgatory, and was pleased to learn I would be serving a celebrity. Madam Celebrity, as we shall call her, was a TV star on a hit show and a frequent guest at Restaurant X. She was infamously particular, and I knew if I could nail this, my job would be safe for at least a few more shifts. Now, the first half of her brunch was a breeze. Wine was poured, food was delivered, coffee was hot. And then it happened. As Madam Celebrity was finishing the last bite of her BLT, I noticed the owner of Restaurant X, a 6-foot-tall Texan, looming behind me. We made eye contact, at which point he cleared his throat and stared at Madam Celebrity's table. I smiled back at him, confused. He cleared his throat again and pointed. I had not crumbed. Fine, I thought. This is fine. Just grab a bread plate and do the damn thing. But there was no bread plate on the table, and the server station was on the other side of the restaurant. My mouth went dry from panic, and I proceeded on pure animal instinct. Grabbing Madam Celebrity's nearly empty wine glass, I swept all of the table's crumbs into the glass, hands shaking violently. Not a graceful execution, I thought, but the deed is done. It was then that Madam Celebrity grabbed my wrist and pinned it to the table with 5 bony witch fingers, forcing my face closer to hers. I wasn't finished with the wine. My time at Restaurant X, however, was totally finished. My neck was saved 3 days later when it was announced that Restaurant X was up for sale, so I was let go, quote-unquote, with everyone else instead of being fired, which is what I totally deserved. I learned a lot that spring about wine regions, about coursing, how to tie a tie. But most importantly, I learned that in this whirlwind business of food, you just never, ever take wine from an old lady. Thank you.
You're listening to Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
And we're back here on The Morning After. In studio, Ian McGregor, president and chief fishmonger at the Lobster Place. Ian, are you a born and bred New Yorker?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Manhattan. Up in Harlem, actually. Not far from 119th Street and Frederick Douglass.
So you're going to have to check it out.
Absolutely.
I don't know where they get their fish from. I had an amazing bass, and I'm not sure. I hope it was from the Lobster Place.
I can neither confirm nor deny that it came from the Lobster Place.
Right now, let's just pretend.
Okay.
No, when I first moved to New York, I lived on 110th and 8th Avenue, and I felt like I had to hike up to Broadway to go eat anywhere, and it wasn't necessarily anywhere I was interested in going to.
Right.
So I'm happy that more things are happening up there. So what was you know, growing up in New York City like? Are you salty from that?
I think I have a unique worldview, having grown up in Manhattan. I wouldn't go so far as to say salty, but you know, you get exposed to a lot of different kinds of people, and there's a lot of upside in that.
No, absolutely. So your parents were in the restaurant industry. Your father.
That's right. My mom and dad worked together.
Is that how they met, or?
As a matter of fact, it is. They
so cute.
My father was tending bar at his restaurant under the stairs. It was a Sunday night.
It was called Under the Stairs.
Yep. Mm-hmm. My mom was on a date with a gentleman who was getting maybe a little bit too fast for her. And the more enhanced version of the story involves her throwing her drink on the suitor.
Classic. Well,
my old man swooping in from behind the bar, and the rest is history.
That is incredible.
It's kind of cool.
That's a great story.
Cool.
So then he has this restaurant under the stairs,
mm-hmm.
and we were talking earlier. You said he's a quirky guy. How did the Lobster Place come out of this restaurant under the stairs?
So he and my mom very quickly got married after they met and continued to work at the restaurant. My dad started out, it was sort of a neighborhood place, and it was kind of a raucous bar scene. And my dad's a pretty easygoing guy. And it started out, he was working the door. And he, one night, tried to eject a couple of guests who were misbehaving. And it was a couple. And the woman punched him in the face with her like big giant diamond engagement ring.
Amazing.
And totally tore his forehead open, and it was a big mess. And from that moment on, my mom insisted that she would work the door and he would stay away from there. I think that at that point he realized that maybe he had to spread his wings and seek another entrepreneurial venture. So naturally he thought, well, I'll just bring lobster from Maine into New York City. I mean, isn't that what you would think too?
Absolutely, with a gash in my head, probably.
Yeah. So he and my mom rented a little tiny store space on Amsterdam Avenue in the 70s, and in a story that predates the current lobster roll craze, started driving up to Portland, Maine in a little pickup truck, picking up lobster a couple hundred pounds at a time. They'd run them down into New York, and then literally pedal them around the neighborhood up there in
wow.
the Upper West Side.
Now, are they from Maine?
No, they're from Long Island.
They just felt like they knew that's exactly
where
to go.
They live in Maine now, and they had always vacationed there growing up, so they sort of had an affinity for it, I guess.
And so now, I mean, obviously, many years later, you've taken over. Was that did you fight against that?
It was sort of a spur of the moment decision. I was in the military and I was getting out of the service and wasn't really sure what I was going to do and was on an interview, sort of planning out my next steps, and the interview went pretty poorly. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I was driving back to Washington. My dad was pretty anxious to get out of the seafood business. He had actually been teaching a bit. He was teaching in the New York public school system and sort of wanted to do that full time. So more or less on a whim, I jumped on my phone and said, all right, Dad, what do you say? come in and sell some fish. I'm going to hawk some crustaceans. And he was like, sweet, you know, see you in a couple weeks.
I want to believe that you actually said, I want to hawk some crustaceans.
Oh, I absolutely did.
That was the selling point.
I'm nowhere near creative enough to come up with that, like, on the spot. I really said that, too.
That's beautiful.
So, the space that you took over, was that the one on Amsterdam, or was that the new... the Chelsea Market space.
We were in Chelsea Market at that point. Sort of in keeping with his adventuresome spirit, my dad moved the lobster place into Chelsea Market in the 90s. He was among the first tenants there alongside Amy's Bread and Manhattan Fruit and a couple of the other larger merchants there. And he was running his strictly wholesale lobster business out of a building that was later... turned into an art gallery and then torn down.
So
across the street from Chelsea Market. And the Chelsea Market developer literally walked into his office one afternoon and said, I want you to move your business into the big giant building across the street. I'm making a fancy gourmet market in there. And my dad said, you realize this is Chelsea in 1995. Nobody shops for gourmet food here.
Wow.
It was a different neighborhood back then. But he decided to go along, and that sort of was the foundation of Lobster Place and Chelsea Market as it exists.
So, who was your main business at that time? If people weren't coming to shop at the Lobster Place from their homes,
he moved the wholesale lobster operation into Chelsea Market and opened up a really small retail store, and. There were a lot of nobodies lining up to come buy fish from him because nobody came there. But he continued to run his wholesale business out of that space. Mm-hmm. And over time, you know, gained a little traction. Chelsea Market became this sort of unique, curious thing that people wanted to check out, and the retail business grew. And then back in 2008, with the High Line imminent, or I guess opening at that point, the neighborhood had evolved so much that it became clear that I couldn't leave our wholesale business there.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling tractor trailers full of lobsters up 16th Street, not conducive these days.
Yeah.
Not the right place for that. So we moved our wholesale operation up to Hunts Point in the Bronx.
Okay.
And started a sort of steady expansion of our retail business in Chelsea Market and made it, you know, twice as big as it had been back in 2008. And then more recently, we sort of did it again.
So... you are chief fishmonger. What does fishmonger actually mean?
Well, I'm not sure.
Okay, what does it entail?
Yeah, fishmonger, basically, I mean, I like to think that I run the business. I'm sure there are plenty of people who work for me who would dispute that. But basically, as fishmongers, we source, process, and sell anything that's edible that comes out of the sea. And it's an interesting business. It's an interesting part of the food industry that's completely unique because it's really sort of the last totally organic and natural food source on Earth. You know, we're taking something totally wild, and you know, with the exception of a farmed fish, of course, out of the ocean, and man doesn't really put his hands on it until it's caught.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it sort of an unpredictable food source that is tough to manage. And where we get, you know, we get the fish from all over the country. Importers bring it in from all over the world. There's no really single source that you can go to buy your fish. It's a lot of relationships with small fish dealers and fishermen and different places. So being a fishmonger really means that we go out and we find it. And then we become a fish travel agent. We figure out how to get it from wherever it is to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to give it to the best restaurants that we can, and of course, shoppers in Chelsea Market.
Do you have a focus on sustainability? Has that been a challenge for you as far as things that you used to sell and now things that you can't sell anymore?
It is a focus, and we come at it from what I think is a somewhat unique perspective. I think it's sort of irresponsible to tell people what they should and shouldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think that the conversation about sustainability these days is a lot about that. What we try to do is present as much transparent information about the products that we sell that we can, and then let the consumer decide whether or not they want to eat it. And we try to be as unbiased as possible, and we try to be as upfront with people as possible. But generally speaking, we stop short of saying we won't source this fish or that fish because we don't think it's right. You know, the fishing industry employs a lot of people, mm-hmm. and a lot of people work very hard to bring fish ashore. And it's not sustainable for us to tell them all of a sudden we're not going to buy your product because, you know, we don't like the way you're doing it or what have you. We sort of try to take a more cooperative approach than that.
So what are all the products that people can buy in the store?
Well,
okay, put it in a nutshell.
I'll put it in a nutshell. On any given day, we have 40 or 50 types of finfish, a whole department focused on shellfish and oysters and clams, shrimp, mussels, crab, that type of thing. We have a really great sushi bar that we just expanded as part of this renovation. We sell about, 10,000 pounds of live lobster, or cooked lobster, every week out of the back of the store. So it's sort of a fish lover's paradise, I guess.
Absolutely. And then you are now opening a restaurant as well.
We are. Adjacent to our store, we are opening Cull and Pistol Oyster Bar. For those of you not aware, a cull is a lobster with one claw, and a pistol is a lobster with no claws. In fisherman parlance, anyway. But it's a great place. We had our first friends and family last night. Had a really great time.
Congratulations.
My head hurts a little. But 47 seats, a great raw bar. Our chef, Dave Siegel, has developed a really nice, globally influenced menu that takes advantage of the access that we have to really great seafood products. So we're pretty excited about it.
So the Lobster Place in Chelsea Market. What's your website?
Lobsterplace.com.
And people can check out, you guys do you do cooking classes as well?
We don't yet, but it's definitely on our list of stuff that we want to sort of get involved with. I actually had two customers come up to me yesterday wanting us to teach an oyster opening class, which seems like it would be worthwhile.
No, absolutely. My friend Nick Padilla, who just opened this restaurant in Alameda, it's kind of a big focus on raw bar, and he taught me how to open oysters.
It can be a dangerous and bloody endeavor if you don't know what you're doing.
Without,
absolutely.
Without question.
With
there's a lot of momentum going into that.
Get your rubber glove.
Absolutely.
You know?
Well, thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the show. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Mr. Levy Dalton. This is The Morning After.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
And we're back here on The Morning After. My second tall, handsome gentleman in studio, Levy Dalton.
Handsome. Oh, okay. What? Self-assessment test.
Self-assessment test. I mean, I know. We all have faces for radio.
He brought a pistol. What did I bring? Nothing.
It's four against one here, baby. I like what I see.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for backing me up. Well,
you're welcome.
Well, aside from whatever you may think, you are a sommelier. You, the wine editor for Eater. Have people here heard of Eater out there?
I've heard of Eater.
I think I have too.
I certainly have.
What's your blog called?
Oh, it's the longest, dumbest name, and if I had to do it over, I would do it like two letters and be like, it's called XY, but it's actually called So You Want to Be a Sommelier
.blogspot.com. So You Want to Be a Sommelier. This sounds like a Genitari rap.
I'm on it. I'm already on it. I got the hook in my head.
But it's actually a terrible name to have when you decide you don't want to be, or when you're not a sommelier anymore. It's an embarrassing name.
Well, aren't you always? Aren't you
it
always?
It stays with you. It's like Nom. You know what I mean? You wake up, you're like, where's my corkscrew? Johnny's coming over the ridge and he wants Muscadet. You know what I mean? You definitely have the terror.
The wine is corked.
You know?
The pit.
Where is the helicopter with the reinforcements of my glass pour?
Of Muscadet.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. So you definitely have that, but I always wait for the comment. Like, so are you still a sommelier at blogspot.com? But it's easiest to just Google my name and blog, and then it comes right up. And it's so much faster. It's what I do.
Well, but also I think what you spend most of your time on right now is your podcast.
Hanging out
I'll drink
house.
To that.
Oh, yeah, the podcast. Yeah. Also that, yeah. Hanging out, watching girls.
Hanging out, watching girls.
Yeah.
And
it's
you
embarrassingly
said it.
True.
I'm ashamed that we both had the thought.
That's too bad. But
no, like, true. No, I think I really might need to pull up what you put on your blog about, like, the show that you want to put out called Wine Girls.
Right.
Which is basically all of those women on girls and men.
Who could not afford to drink good wine.
Yeah, trying to break into the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the same thing. It's like, oh, you want your first wine director job, and it's hard. It's the same thing as trying to be breaking into a novelist or something.
Sure,
like that.
Sure. An e-book
writer.
It's New
York, you know? It's
right, right. Those girls are like drinking a bottle of Barefoot Pinot Grigio listening to Animal Collective.
Well,
so,
see.
Give them a couple of years.
Like, I think Marnie is definitely.
Oh yeah, Marnie definitely is
a class
aiming.
Growth family.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Shoshana is always going to just ask if they have a Sauvignon Blanc.
Well, yeah,
regardless
of
where she is or a Malbec.
Yeah. I had this whole thing about how she was a wine virgin
or a Sancerre.
And, you know,
yep.
She hadn't tried, and then Ray introduced her to Sherry.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know the whole, but anyway, it's
my favorite was what is Marnie's boyfriend
Charlie
is super into Riesling, right? And he is a little uncomfortable about talking about sweetness levels that he enjoys. And then he creates what, like an app help people guide themselves to the
he's just cup. Left the show. R.I.P. Charlie Abbott.
No, really?
We'll miss you.
Did
yep.
he get,
I saw
he...
him on the L train the other day and he looked a little downtrodden, and I wanted to be like, it's all right, you freed yourself.
Was he in the SUV when that guy died mudding? The guy from Bushwhacked?
Oh, no.
Buckwild?
I don't think so.
Are we spoiling? We can't spoil
no, no, no.
Spoiler
he just,
right
he
now?
Just left the show.
Okay.
I'm not sure why.
That's too bad.
So
yeah. I like that dude. He was the sympathetic character, you know? Ray's too much like me. Like,
he was.
I actually look at Ray, and I'm like,
that's why
wow.
I thought you said he liked Sherry.
It's amazing you put me on screen
that,
like this.
That actor, we have the same agent, and I see him at our office more than I see run into friends of mine, and every time he looks at me like I killed his mother. He's like this in the elevator.
Since no one can see Jen's face,
I want you to imagine. Don't
it's
describe
just,
it.
It's some sharp, piercing eyes.
It's just a non
looking her
it's
down.
It's a non sequitur party this morning. This is what happens when I have rum and coffee
at the same time.
At the same, well, in rapid succession.
So Levy, so you got your start, like I guess. Take me to the moment that you started getting into wine.
It was honestly, it was about more about the moment that I didn't get involved, because that was a long time. That we were just poor. We lived in a trailer park. There was always something wrong, like major problems like that would happen.
There was a wheel falling off of the trailer.
Yeah, exactly.
Shit, we got a puller.
No, I still remember, like, you know, like hearing the rain falling and seeing it dripping inside, and because it was Oregon, it used to rain all the time. I remember we used to drive around in a car where you had to hold the passenger door closed because it was like it wouldn't stay closed. You had to hold it closed. I remember running out of gas because the gas meter didn't work in a car and we had to push the car. I mean, just we were poor and it wasn't about wine. It was no one talked about wine. Like, I remember one time my dad got some like Al Madden or Charles Masson or something, and he like knocked it into the computer keyboard and we were scraping out wine out of the keys for a long time. But that was the extent of my wine experience for a long time. And then it turned out that I was freakishly tall and people were like, yo, can you buy booze for me? And that really set in motion a lot of things.
What did they ask you to buy?
At that time, it was big on the Cisco, and then also the Jack Daniel's Country Coolers were a big thing.
But, were you buying 40s?
Tennessee
Tip?
That was a big... I mean, 40 for me was... That was a different culture. That was really associated with, like, Boys in the Hood. And that was a different...
Oh, scene. I see. Okay.
You know what I mean? We were... It was
I didn't make that distinction. My alcoholism is colorblind.
We were crackers. We were, you know, we were white kids.
Okay.
In the sticks. And so we didn't... you know, there's social distinctions.
Sure, sure.
Even at that,
I respect.
Even at that time.
So, maybe in Oregon. In Kentucky, there wasn't.
Old English was seen as, you know, kind of like the natural wine now. Like, ooh, student people are into that, but other people really don't drink that. You know, any of that kind of
So thing. You're buying booze for people. Yeah.
Well.
And I you're mean, like, what, 16?
Hopefully me. Yeah. Also, I knew older people who would help me with this, this goal. But that started the thing. And I started reading, I don't know. I get really into things. That was a short progression from, like, drinking country coolers to, like, reading the Wine Spectator was, like, a year.
Wow.
So I don't know how to explain that, but I always felt like there was something more to know, and, you know, it was a different era, too. There was a lot less. You couldn't just Google things. It seemed like a bigger thing to find out about stuff. It was a bigger thing. It was harder back then to find out about stuff, in a way.
Right. And now there we have Riesling apps for our iPads.
That Charlie made.
That Charlie made. God bless him.
Well, I mean, but I do think that learning about wine is a way to learn about culture and to learn about geography in a way that not all topics are.
I think it's great. I mean, it really helped later. When I wanted to know about art history, a lot of that history of wine is like the same history. You're like, oh, this ethnic group moved there and they killed all those people and they created this art and they made that wine.
And it's that's why that grape is there, yeah.
Thing, you know? And you learn about the same towns. You're like, oh, Avignon, you know? It's culturally important for several reasons, you know what I mean? It's chartreuse, it's popes, it's Chateauneuf de Pape, you know? There's a lot going on.
So you worked for several parts of the Dynex group, right?
You're saying I get fired a lot? Is that what you're trying to
imply? You get hired a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that you're, you know, a gentleman of leisure. You're ready to go where your heart takes you.
Right.
Something like that.
No, I was, for a long time, I was like a tournant kind of sommelier for Daniel. I would work at different places that they needed help because that's an organization that hires people who often have a visa situation because they're on a J-1 or they're French and they're here for a while and they need to go back and take care of something. So they would move me around to sort of fill in those things.
Spots.
But that was really exciting for me because going to a new restaurant, whether I'm a customer or whether I work there, is like the most exciting thing for me. I really love that. And I think that goes back to being a kid and never doing it. Like, we ate Hungry Man meals and we went to Chuck E. Cheese on a special day and we had brunch at McDonald's. And so, like, the whole idea that you could go out and go to a nice place and have a nice meal was just, it was like seeing Blackstone's Magic and Illusion. Like, it was like, wow, all these fancy little tricks. And, like, to work in them, you actually got to, like, figure out how the box worked where you could saw the lady in half. You're like, wow, that's how you guys do it here? That's amazing. I've always watched that trick and wondered, you know. That's kind of how it went. So it was always exciting. And New York's very about neighborhoods. You know, and you don't really realize that until you get out of the one you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you see, for better or worse, what a different neighborhood can and can't do. And that's very related to what sells in terms of wine. And it's fascinating, actually. And sometimes very frustrating, but you learn from what doesn't work. And you sometimes try to make it work, and sometimes you don't. You know, you give up.
So, not speaking of giving up, but you've kind of been able to stop somming.
Yeah.
And kind of focus more towards the wine media side of
I think
things.
What happens is that you get a certain number of scripts. It's just like being an actor. And you're like, wow, that sounds like a movie I'd really like to make. And then sometimes you don't. Sometimes you're like Robert Downey Jr. And you're like, wow, for 10 years I'm not getting any good scripts. Or like, you want me to be in the Goofy movie? Really? You see me as Goofy?
Yeah, that's what
gonna
it
work?
Is. He's just turning them all down.
So you end up not taking certain opportunities, and it turns out that other opportunities that, you know, I think it's really important when someone says, hey, do you want to do this? If that first reaction is, yeah, then do that and figure out how to make that work. And I think that's where we're at now. Like, I got a couple of those things that happen to be more media related. And I also think it's a time where people are with wine sales. Sometimes people are a little like, oh, wow, I don't know if I want you to have so much personality. You know, since 2008, people are like, yeah, maybe let's play it safer. Let's try to appeal to everyone. You know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think it's if you have a point of view, it's not always so sellable right now, you know, in terms of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So, but media loves a point of view. Media thrives on a point of view. Media desperately wants a point of view to write for them and give them content. So that's an easy sell.
And an eater is your primary avenue at this moment?
I don't know.
I would say I'll drink to that. You do it
bi-weekly. People listen to the podcast, so. I mean, I don't know. It's different. Because, what happens is very different. Like, I know that if I write something on my personal blog, that I'm not necessarily going to get a phone call or an email. Like, dude, how could you say that? But I know for a fact, if I write that same thing on Eater, that I will.
Uh-huh.
So that modulates some of what you might want to do. Like, sure. I get more patient and more kind of fair when the volume meter is turned up, I think. And a little bit more funny and a little bit more just kind of me, I think, when it's more personal. Because you can do that, you know? I think that, I don't know. I don't know what that means. And I think the podcast is somewhere in between. Because actually the podcast isn't really me. It's the people coming on. So
sure.
We kind of let them...
Another feeling. Thing.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like this right sure, now. You're like, I actually wanted to say something
just
there.
Totally anonymous.
Douche, and you kept talking.
I actually have a word maximum I'm given per episode.
Oh, really?
They come in and taser me if I meet it.
I actually take a lot of my stuff out of the podcast a lot.
Do you?
It was really helpful to do my own edits. Like, eventually my producer was like, dude, you should just do this because you can actually hear yourself and how you make this worse. And I was like, well, you're right.
Great. Thank you so much.
No, but it was true, though. Because, you know, if you tend to dominate, like when someone's about to tell you the thing, you know, about what that meant to them, and you're like, and the next joke, you know what I mean? You can ruin that flow. So I think it's important to, if you're, you know, what I had to learn, it's the same as wine. So 5:30, 6 o'clock reservations, people come in, and you're all jazzed up on coffee, and you just did the staff meeting, and you're ready to sell, and you're ready to talk to people. And not necessarily do those people want to talk to you. Like, people who show up at a restaurant at 5:30 don't necessarily want to talk to the sommelier, and they don't necessarily want you to refill a lot of wine for them, because they're going a little slower. They're taking it a little different, unless it's a pre-theater restaurant. And I had to learn to just chill and not go to them too much and give them more time with the list. Because I would go and they would be like, we will tell you when we're ready. And then I would be like hurt and I would take that energy into the next meeting when people did want to talk to me. You know what I mean? And I had to learn to like step back. And it's the same with the podcast. I had to learn to like let people do their thing and step back. And that was like one of the most valuable things I ever learned. Because that's the same with wine. You have to let the wine tell you what it's about and not like tell the wine or tell other people what you think the wine is before you've had that chance.
It's the beauty of a co-host.
I mean,
she is quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, I mean, it's truly about listening and also working in wine. You know, I just give the guest simple questions, you know, price point, you know, light, medium, full, fruit, earth. You know, what are you looking for? And then you just listen. And for the most part, what they're going to say is not right or not what exactly they're looking for. But I feel like it's your job to translate it. And just like, you know, interviewing, it's about listening to the person and feeling out what the next question's going to be.
Well, I do think it's very venue specific. And, you know, we chose a certain kind of podcast to do it mm-hmm. a certain way. And that's what works for us. And it's the same with restaurants. Like mm-hmm. some restaurants that really is true that people are looking for you to tell them what to drink. And they get very frustrated when you won't.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, why won't you just make this? We just want to have good wine. What do you not understand about
that?
We want to have
mean?
A good Brunello, you know? And so you need to, like, listen to that. But in other restaurants, it's really true that people don't want you to come and tell them what to drink. And you have to listen to that. And, again, that goes back to neighborhood and goes back to, you know, what people are used to in terms of dining and how much money they usually spend and the whole thing. It's way more of a social interaction than people give it credit for. I think the biggest mistake you can do thinking about wine is to think it's just about wine or it's even primarily about wine. I think it's usually not. It's usually just much more about the vibe of the social interaction and the million variables that are associated with that.
So how do you keep up the bi-weekly podcast? For me personally, like putting together a show every single Sunday is, you know, a solid amount of work with a full-time job.
Yeah. I did do it when I had a full-time job. Now I don't have a full-time job. I mean, I guess the writing is a lot, mm-hmm. but, what we do is we just try to, maximize time management. So we record a bunch in a row, and then we release them not at the same time.
Got
so
it. That makes sense.
Like the travel time, the setup, the breakdown, the scheduling, all of that goes into one day where you record several. Sometimes it makes us less topical. Like there have been times where like people have been like, it's like a hurricane came through, and then we actually had a hurricane come through, and then when you release that interview, that comment seems much more callous. You know what I mean? So you got to be careful about stuff like that. And then
don't talk about weather patterns.
Well, also just anything. People are like, so I'm going to be at this place on Monday, and you're like, which Monday do you mean? Because we're going to release this in a month.
Got it.
So we've had that challenge. I think at some point I'm kind of dialing it back where I want to do it more like direct as possible, or more direct. Because, like, I would like to get on the podcast right now and talk about my feelings towards Boston. You know, I have a lot of friends there. But when you're not recording all the time, it's harder to do that, I guess, is what I would say. So it's a give and take with that.
So, well, good on you for getting 750 as your sponsor. That's awesome. We've had them on the show.
Sense.
And, I mean, that company has exploded. And it makes so much sense. 750 is you know, basically the most amazing online
which online, there you find it
exactly online. I guess I would call it like a search engine of distributors, wine distributors in New York City. You can create a search so specific, which I did this over New Year's, where you're just like, okay, I want you know, magnums, I want it to be red, I want it to be from Italy, and I want it to be through these different producers. And it's, you can get that specific on that search engine, and
it also gives you tasting templates, so you can.
Well, yeah,
it's amazing.
You just get an electronic, tasting booklet. So you're going to a wine tasting, and instead of having like a big pad of paper and a pen and a glass and a bunch of people around you spitting and you know and all that stuff, you've got it right on your phone where you can just be like beep bop beep bop.
And I've been busted on that several times because I'll go in and automatically, after years and years and years, pick up the booklet.
Sure.
But they're at the tastings now all the time. And
yep.
I really think most of the reason they're at the tastings is to remind me to put the booklet down. They're like, Levy, we sponsor your show. Why don't you just put the booklet down? And then, so now I'm trained to not do the booklet.
Just but it took tell like them it's for your collection.
A couple months. Yeah, well, it's also a problem because I have a 15-year collection of tasting books. And, you know, I live in a small apartment. And so I think maybe this phone thing is making a lot more sense.
Well, Levy, where can we check out your podcast?
Oh, it's I'll Drink to That with Levy Dalton, and there's a little exclamation point in there. I'm not going to tell you exactly where in that sentence, but it's on iTunes. It's on Stitcher. We have a dedicated website. I mean, we try to find you, man. I don't know why you won't call me, but I've been trying to leave messages for you to listen to my show.
I feel found.
I feel dumbfounded. We do a lot of outreach. Right? I'm the dumb one.
Awesome. I can't wait to check it out. I'm going to do it.
It's been great talking with you.
Thanks.
So happy you're here.
No, it was a lot of fun.
Thank you
very much.
So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with what's on the menu at Chardonnay's.
You're listening to Long by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Iggy Dean, you've been listening to. Speaking of Iggy Dean, shameless plug, the talent and wonder that is Iggy Dean is currently part of an awesome collective of musicians called Road to Bonnaroo, and they're all vying for a couple of extra slots to go play Bonnaroo. And voting ends on Wednesday. So if you like what you hear here on Heritage, because we frequently feature her music, because she's awesome, You can.
And she might know some people.
She might know some people. I don't know. You can give her a listen and give her a vote at the following address on a polygon on my phone. Just give it a quick second. Here we go. It's at bonnaroo.sonicbids.com and vote for Iggy Dean. Speaking of awesome things, so I was thinking about Chardonnays. I'm always thinking about Chardonnays. Oh. What's on the menu with Chardonnays? I gotta find out who does those shingles. I was thinking about, you know, what is on the menu at Chardonnays this week. And I was having some nostalgic conversations with some elementary school friends of mine because they just had babies. Because that's what they're all doing right now. And we were talking about...
I mean, we are 21, so it's kind of around that
right
time.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. We were talking about our school and what we ate in the cafeteria, and I thought, what better celebration of that time than a junior high cafeteria edition of Chardonnays.
Like Chardonnays. What's
on the menu with Chardonnays? Did you like the accidental Foley that I did there?
I mean, I absolutely loved it. Yeah, like a cafeteria sound.
My mother, who's a frequent guest call-in and friend of our show, she made an album when I was in high school. Hi, Mom. I love you. Of Christian pop music. And there was a sequence in the middle of this album that featured several local actors reenacting a scene from the Bible. It was when Mary washes the feet of Jesus with her hair. And the Foley work on that is stunning. It was pretty much 25 men in a recording studio the size of a Starbucks bathroom just clanging wine glasses together and like forks and pouring wine. And it was so cool. I remember it was the first time I'd ever seen live Foley being done. And I was like, yeah, Mom, you got it under control. Okay, so junior high cafeteria edition of Chardonnays. I've given this a lot of thought. It's going to go down like this. It's a tasting menu. It's a preefie. We're going to start off with some under-chilled carton of 1% chocolate milk, followed by a de-thawed pea and carrot cup with a pear-filled Jell-O heart. Course 3 features a Frito pie with an optional taco powder upgrade for 99 cents. Depends on how much money you have in the milk pouch. Rounding off the government-sanctioned feast will be a vanilla wafer banana pudding with an Oreo crumble and a half-eaten bag of Gushers you traded for the answers for your geography homework at Chardonnays.
One more Chardonnays, Joe.
No, that's it. That's it. That's all we get. Oh. What's on the menu
with Chardonnays? Chardonnays, our mythical restaurant that celebrates all bad food and wine trends. It's doing catering now, obviously, for schools.
Oh, absolutely. This is a Michelle Obama program. She got a hold of us. She said, look, you know, we've got $600 in the budget. And we want to keep them kids healthy. So
nobody cuts corners like Chardonnays.
Oh, Mish, I love her. Okay, well, I'd like to pose this to our guests because I'm not sure what your education backgrounds were.
I do know who Michelle Obama is. That's that where you're going.
Good for you.
Okay.
So do I.
Do you know? I think she's just talking about completing junior high.
Okay. I was wondering if you could give us a single junior high cafeteria item to go on our prefee menu.
Cool Ranch Doritos.
Bam.
I would like spaghetti with the sort of watery meat sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Like more like chili and ketchup.
That's like neon orange.
Yeah.
Amazing. And I mean, that's why they had to give you those trays with the little compartments in it. It was like eating Ninjetta Wet. You know that Ethiopian dish where they give you the little like pita compartments? It was just like a plastic version of that because it would all run together.
I would always buy those Little Debbie like Nutter Butter bars where they're like the wafers, the chocolate with like the peanut butter.
And then take the layers apart?
Yeah, separately. That was it. And then I'd be starving. Because you just, that's all I ate.
You just fed your body high fructose corn syrup and chocolate.
Speaks to so many things I did in middle school.
I can't wait for this, Preefy. I think we're going to make a lot of money.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a wonderful show. Ian, Levy, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully we'll see you again soon. Jen, I know I'll see you again soon.
I want some lobster.
I want to see Ray. Can I see Ray soon?
With a glass of Muscadet. Yeah, we're going to hook it up. We're going to eat Muscadet and lobster with Ray on the morning after on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.